today from Providence, Rhode Island in Northern California. Welcome to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we're a proud member of the Coffee Party USA Network. And we've all seen the iconic posed picture of Winston Churchill. You know of what I speak. He's in a three-piece suit. He's sitting and leaning forward. His hand is on his hip, and he has this scowl and a look of resolve. And I presume that this picture was taken during World War II. And that has become the Winston Churchill that we know. And we've heard his quotes, you know, he promised you nothing more than, I'm paraphrasing it to accommodate the music group, but blood, sweat, and tears. But his background is far more complex. And that complexity built the man that he became. And there's a great new book out about this. And to learn more, we have the author of that book, Simon Reed, author of the new book, Winston Churchill Reporting, to tell us more. And Simon, welcome to the Tim Danahy Show.
Hey, thanks, Tim. Great to be here.
Well, it's a delight to have you. I enjoyed the book. I enjoyed it on a couple of levels. You know, so often these, I'll call them tomes, you know, these big, huge biographies, they get lost in themselves, truthfully. But your book was just, it was a refreshing read. And when reading it, I really got a lot of insights into Winston Churchill. You did a good job with the management of how the book was written.
Great, thanks. You know, when I wrote the book, Tim, it's got, you know, it has elements of history and it has elements of biography, but I actually consider it an action adventure story. Obviously, it's, you know, it's a true story. It's work of nonfiction, but it's an adventure story nevertheless. It just happens to feature Winston Churchill. And, you know, sort of like you said in your introduction, when we think of Churchill, we think of him as sort of Britain's iconic World War II leader and everything that entails. You know, he's got the ever-present cigar, the bulldog scowl, and, of course, these amazing speeches that, you know, still really pack a punch 70 years down the road. I've always been curious, though, about what sort of created that character, what kind of created this man that we've come to lionize and that still stands very large over history. Obviously, Churchill had a very active life, not short on accomplishment. But I think when you go back and you look at everything in his life, I think the most formative period for him were the years 1895 to 1900, which are the years covered in this book, where he worked as a war correspondent for various newspapers. He was between the ages of 20 and 25 in the period that this book covers. And during that time, he covered various wars of empire in Cuba, India's northwest frontier, which is today the region of Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Sudan, and South Africa. And you know, when I wrote the book, even before I started writing it, I was very much aware that I wanted it to be an adventure story. I wanted it to move very quickly, and I didn't want to sort of get buried in a lot of details that had been previously written about before, because, you know, there are so many books on the guy. So when I wrote it, I kind of wanted it to have sort of like the velocity of a bullet. You know, I wanted it to be a page turner.
Well, where it really comes forth for me was your writing on the last charge at Omdurman in the Sudan, a Khartoum for common reference. But when you wrote of that, you caught the horrors of the battle really well. It transcended the biography, and it became that adventure of which you spoke, you know, so it really was fascinating, the style and the manner in which you wrote it. So I really have to tip my hat to you.
Thank you very much. That the chapter you mentioned about the battle at Omdurman, that was actually my favorite part of the book to write. And during the battle, Churchill takes part in sort of the last great cavalry charges in British military history, where he's riding with a 350-man regiment, and they charge a line of about 2,000 enemy Sudanese warriors, and the his descriptions of combat and of these two sort of lines of men colliding, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's the stuff of a Hollywood epic, and he actually emerges through from this like terrible ordeal unscathed, without a scratch. He actually kills three men. in the battle, but he emerges himself without a scratch, even though around him horses are being, you know, stabbed with spears and men are being hacked to death. And when I was writing the book, it occurred to me in all these campaigns he covered how different the global landscape would look today if he'd, you know, if he'd died. He had many, many close calls, but miraculously he sort of came through all these campaigns with a little more than a scratch. It's quite remarkable.
Well, really, I can think of, in addition to Winston Churchill's, two other iconic figures in American history that had the same thing that you just can't explain. One would be George Washington, and the other one would be Teddy Roosevelt. George Washington had a bullet entry through the front of his coat and an exit through the back, and he didn't get a scratch. You know, it's how do you explain these things? And similar with Winston Churchill. But what I want to do is backtrack just a little bit because, you know, him showing up, the reason he's there, it's kind of odd. You know, it's kind of like a Forrest Gump, you know, kind of, it's not like he's a lover of military or anything, but I want to take it back even further. And that's his youth because, Simon, I look at it, and I was thinking, you know, his descriptions and the way that his father was describing him, the way his school people were describing him. I mean, if he was alive here in the 21st century, one would think that they would have him on some kind of child maintenance drug or something. He was not at first considered a rising star, was he?
No, he was not. His childhood was very tumultuous, I guess you could say, for lack of a better word. You know, he was. His father was Lord Randolph Churchill, who was sort of a big player in British politics, was considered a rising star. But he was not a very pleasant man. He sort of shoots himself in the foot and derails his own political career. But Lord Randolph was not a warm father figure. In fact, neither one of Churchill's parents, when Churchill was young, would be considered ideal parents. Lord Randolph treated Winston terribly. You know, said horrible things to him. I think today we'd go so far as to say Lord Randolph was emotionally and verbally abusive. The things he said to his son were despicable. And Lady Randolph, Churchill's mother, he adored her, but he sort of equated her to some, like a planet or a star, some celestial body that's, you know, beautiful to look at, but you admire it from a distance. And neither parent was really very warm or loving. Churchill's father just thought he was destined for failure. Didn't think Churchill would amount to anything. Never really wasted an opportunity to put his son down. Never really paid him any compliments. Neither parent ever came to sort of visit Churchill when he was away at school. Obviously, in those days, you didn't like go to school and then come home in the afternoons. You were sent off to boarding schools, and you know, you were there for months at a time. Neither parent really came to visit him. His teachers dismissed him as sort of a troublemaker, sort of lackadaisical, didn't really excel at anything other than English and history. Those were his two passions, and he did well in those. But he was kind of, for lack of a better word, he was sort of a failure at school. It wasn't until he sort of gets into the military academy at Sandhurst that he starts to excel. But his father just didn't think Churchill was going to amount to anything. And there's a letter that Lord Randolph sends Winston at some point, you know, in school career, and I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but it basically says, you know, if you don't apply yourself, your life's going to amount to nothing. You're not going to accomplish anything, and you're going to be an utter failure. And of course, you know, we know what Churchill became. And it's interesting that you do mention his childhood, Tim, because Churchill's father, when Churchill was 20, you know, so Churchill was still relatively young. And I think Churchill's entire life was really spent trying to live up to his father's expectations. You know, his father had all these sort of expectations for him, and Churchill never sort of met any of them while the father was still alive. And there was a story I read several years ago where Lady Soames, Mary Churchill, Churchill's youngest daughter, recounted a story where Churchill, near the end of his life, she was talking with him, and she said, you know, Papa, you've accomplished so much. Is there anything in your life that you regret? And he said, I regret that my father never lived to see me accomplish anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's very telling. I think it's amazing. It's incredibly sad that a man who accomplished as much as Churchill did at the end of his life can be upset that his father never lived to see him accomplish anything. And I think that's sort of very telling of, sort of what heavy an influence Churchill's father had over him his entire life.
Well, just to kind of give the background, if I may, from the book, the headmaster at St. George's School in Ascot, where Winston was sent, said he has no ambition. He said he's in constant trouble to everybody. He's always in some scrape or another. He cannot be trusted to behave himself. You wrote this beautifully, and this is where your British phraseology comes through. I love it, and that is Winston quickly dazzled school officials with a blaze of complacency. Only a Brit could say that, Simon. I want you to know that. But then you go on to quote, his forgetfulness, carelessness, unpunctuality, and irregularity in every way we have really been so serious that I write to ask you when he's at home to speak very gravely to him on the subject. And then you also mentioned habitual negligence. And then, again, I do this just to show the emotional hole that Winston Churchill had to rise. And, he said the father he saw a bleak future. I'm just trying to see some of the places that I have highlighted. He just said that it wasn't going to happen. He said his son was sorely lacking in common sense and intelligence.
Right.
And within that framework, you mentioned that he went to the military academy, and something was lit at that point. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, Churchill. He was always fascinated by sort of military history. Churchill's, sort of illustrious ancestor, the first Duke of Marlborough, had defeated the French in a series of battles in the early 18th century, essentially at the Battle of Blenheim. And so the British nation bestowed upon him a palatial estate known as Blenheim Palace, which you can obviously still go and tour today. That's where Churchill was actually born. And Churchill, he was enamored by Napoleonic history and Napoleonic wars. War had a romantic notion for him. He sort of envisioned it as, great armies meeting on the field of battle beneath unfurled flags with cannons booming and whatnot. And he, as a child, started collecting toy soldiers. He amassed a collection of about 1,500 lead soldiers. And one day, Lord Randolph pays a visit to Churchill's nursery, where Churchill is playing with his soldiers, and he sees the way Churchill has arranged them all on the floor. He's got them organized in an amazing fashion, and it's one of the few times that Lord Randolph sort of ever shows any interest in anything Churchill is doing. And he's struck by the way Churchill has organized all his toy soldiers on the floor of his playroom. And so he thinks, maybe the military, will be a career for my son. So Churchill does enter Sandhurst, the British Military Academy. I mean, it takes him a couple of tries to get in because he fails the test the first time around, and he ultimately qualifies for the cavalry. But this is not good enough for Lord Randolph, and he sends Churchill a blistering letter. Chastising him for making it into the cavalry and not the infantry. The cavalry are second-rate soldiers, he tells Churchill. Really what was going on was Lord Randolph was just unhappy that he'd have to pay extra money for, horses and bridlery and everything that comes with being in the cavalry. But you're right, when he does enter Sandhurst, Tim, something does sort of ignite underneath him, because Churchill now isn't sitting in a classroom having to learn Latin and mathematics. He's sitting there and he's learning military history. He's learning the art of fortification. He's learning about armaments. He's learning about demolition and cavalry charges and troop formations. And these are all things that kind of stir his imagination. War had sort of kind of always fueled his imagination, and so this really played into his passion.
Okay, I tell you what, Simon, let's do this. Let's break for a quick commercial, and then when we come back, I want to talk about this transition, because this is not just like being in the military. This there's a different aspect to all of this that I think that needs to be told, and then we can kind of get the alternative history on this thing, and I think it's really fascinating. We're talking with Simon Reed, who is the author of Winston Churchill Reporting, the new book out. It's Adventures of a Young War Correspondent, and you're listening to him here on The Tim Danny Show. We'll be right back. You preserve a nation one community at a time, with shared knowledge and an informed electorate, with many voices speaking with civility and integrity. And we will preserve our nation when we participate, we learn, we discuss, we vote. We are the Coffee Party USA. Join us today. CoffeePartyUSA.com. Welcome to this edition of the Tim Danny Show's American History Minutes here at Danahy.com. During the American Revolution in 1778, the Iroquois nation sided with the British forces. George Washington knew Americans were vulnerable to attacks from northern Pennsylvania, so he instructed General John Sullivan to lead a campaign to destroy Iroquois crops and villages north of eastern Pennsylvania. However, the American army needed the help of the Lenape Indians in order to find the Iroquois, traverse the territory, and avoid ambush. So Washington and Sullivan invited the Lenapes to join the American independence movement and offered the Lenape Indians territory to be the 14th state and give them representation in Congress. The Lenape accepted the offer and fulfilled their side of the bargain, but the United States did not honor the treaty signed in Pittsburgh. This prompted one Lenape chief to say, "We've heard many promises that should be given no more notice than the chirping of birds in the woods." If promises were kept, the Lenape Nation, not Vermont, would have been America's 14th state. This story has been brought to you by The Tim Danahy Show. Like us on Facebook at Tim Danahy Show. Follow us on Twitter at Tim Danahy Show. Or sign up and listen here at Danahy.com. Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and I'm really just enjoying talking to a good man, the author Simon Reed, and we're talking about his new book that's out now. It's called Winston Churchill Reporting, Adventures of a Young War Correspondent, and it's such a fascinating book because it does... it delves into the history of Winston Churchill, but it also delves into British history, and it as Simon mentioned, it has an adventure component to it that really makes it a joy to read. It is not a stuffy biography of Winston Churchill. It's a lively and interesting aspect to read, biography to read, just because of the various aspects which Simon has inserted into it. It's really fabulous. So, Simon, I tip my hat to you on that.
Thanks, Tim.
Well, we talk about, you know, his childhood, and then he goes into military academy. It sparks something. And you touched upon something about Lord Randolph not being thrilled about him being in the cavalry. But being in the military at that time, it requires parental financial support. This is not a free ride, correct?
No, you're absolutely correct. To be an officer in the cavalry was an expensive undertaking. You had to pay for your horses, or, you know, ponies as they called them. You had to pay for all your bridlery, your saddles, and all the equipment. You had to pay for the care of the horses. And, you know, if you're going to be an officer in the cavalry, you've got to live the life of a gentleman officer. You're expected to have a servant to help look after you. It's a very sort of upper crust existence. And that takes money. And it was a Churchillian trait. The Churchills always spent well beyond their means. And Lord and Lady Randolph, Churchill's parents, Lord and Lady Churchill, they weren't poor by any stretch of the imagination. They were very well off, but they were social animals, and they threw big parties. Lady Randolph was in demand as a hostess. She was very beautiful, elegant woman, and they traveled and whatnot, and they were sort of more interested in the high life and having a good time, really, than financial security. And so going into the cavalry, Churchill Williams of the Cavalry was sort of a financial drain on the family. And Churchill himself also enjoyed the good life. You know, he did not want to live like a pauper. And so he had to sort of make money somehow, and that's kind of how the whole war correspondent thing comes into play.
Let's make that trend. I think Americans of this era can relate. Okay, he's in the military, he's a lieutenant, but you have to support yourself. So he shops the idea of writing stories from war areas of conflict to support this. So while he wasn't necessarily serving in the military in some of the early conflicts, he nonetheless was on the lines and experiencing it. It's kind of an odd situation.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, when he joins the military in February 1895, the British Empire, you know, by this time it covers like a quarter of the globe. It's at relative peace. There's not a whole lot going on. And Churchill, he hated boredom and he hated inactivity. He always had to keep himself occupied with something. And he was curious as to how he might hold up under enemy fire. You know, I've never been in the military, but I imagine that most people who are in the military sort of always wonder what will happen when they come under enemy fire for the first time. And so he was curious about this, but he was also bored to death just sitting around his barracks outside of London. You know, he wanted to see some action. I think today we'd almost call him an adrenaline junkie. And so in Cuba at this time in 1895, Cuba has sort of risen up in rebellion against its Spanish colonial masters. And so Churchill's reading accounts of this war in Cuba between Cuban rebels and Spanish troops, and he thinks, I might find some action there. And so he decides he's going to travel to Cuba to see the war and, if possible, report on it. And his intentions, his goals here were threefold, actually. Number one, he just wanted some excitement in his life. Number two, he was curious as to how he might hold up under enemy fire. And number three, already at this age, at the age of 20, he's thinking that he wants to follow his father's footsteps and go into politics. But you need a platform. You need to have a public persona in order to go into politics. And he thought that maybe going off and taking part in active combat, distinguishing himself in war, making a name for himself, would be a way to sort of start building a political platform. So he writes a letter to his mother in October 1895, and he says, I dare say this is going to come as a shock to you, but I've decided to go off to a war zone in the West Indies. But his mother, it was up to her to pay his way, because obviously, you know, he was going there unofficially, like you said, Tim, and the British Army had no business being in Cuba. But that didn't stop Churchill. So he writes his mother a letter. His mother sort of taken aback, but she agrees, yes, she'll fund his trip over there. And he lands himself a contract with the London Daily Graphic, which is a now defunct newspaper. And in November 1895, he gets on a boat and he heads on over to America, spends some time in New York City, loves it, and then makes his way down to Cuba. But, you know, what we need to keep in mind when we talk about this period is that Churchill is still a soldier in Her Majesty's Army, and it was uncommon for soldiers to also be reporters. But then again, not everyone's a Churchill, and, you know, what Churchill wanted, Churchill got.
Well, what I found two things interesting. I'm sitting here on the tail end of a cold. But there's a couple things that I found interesting regarding his time that he spent in Cuba. And then I would tie that to the time that he spent in India, West India fighting. And one is he was an unrepentant believer in empire. And in Cuba, he had great sympathy for the Spanish Empire and kind of was taking a lesson in on the death rattle of a former empire. And the other issue was the tacticus of war to which he was exposed. and how really nothing has changed from then and now in regards to rebel insurgencies and countries fighting colonial powers.
Yeah, you know, Churchill was a staunch imperialist, and he was up until the day he died. And, you know, to people born in more modern times, obviously, you know, colonialism and imperialism is something to frown upon. But, of course, Churchill came of age when the British Empire was at the height of its power, you know, the largest empire the world had ever seen. You know, everyone in the UK, you know, especially from the echelons of upper society from which Churchill came, you know, they were proud imperialists. They were proud of what Britain had had accomplished. And when he went to, well, it's interesting. When he went to Cuba, at first he was sort of sympathetic towards the Cuban rebels because he knew that the Spanish were sort of taxing the Cubans heavily and were sort of taking all the tobacco and sugar and everything else that Cuba had to offer in terms of natural resources and taking it for themselves. And so he was kind of sympathetic to the Cubans. After he gets there, though, he suddenly realizes, oh, you know what? Spanish troops care as much about the Spanish Empire as British soldiers care about the British Empire. It had never occurred to him before that other European powers might care about their colonial possessions as much as the UK does. And the second thing that happens is, you know, he arrives in Cuba. He's attached to a Spanish column. And this column is basically charged with making its way through the Cuban jungle and supplying sort of Spanish garrisons at Cuban villages, you know, across the island. And, you know, the jungle, this is jungle warfare. You know, the jungle is hot. It's fetid. You've got vegetation encroaching on all sides. The Spanish troops, they have to hack their way through with machetes, and they've got to, you know, lead their horses across creeks and bogs and swamps, and it's pretty miserable. It's hot and everything. And the Cubans use the vegetation of the jungle to great effect. You know, they do these guerrilla hit-and-run raids, which to Churchill was completely alien. You know, you'd be walking through the jungle, suddenly Cubans burst out of the vegetation, fire a few shots, and then disappear. This was not warfare to Churchill. Sort of like what I stated earlier, Churchill had a very specific idea of what warfare was, and it was two armies meeting on an open field of battle. To Churchill, this was a very cowardly way of fighting, and so he sort of loses sympathy for the Cubans and ends up sympathizing more with the Spanish. He thought the way the Cubans were fighting was very dirty. You know, he didn't think it was fair. But you're absolutely right. I mean, this is what we see with insurgencies, and we see it even, you know, we see it even more to a greater extent when he's on the northwest frontier of India, you know, 2 years later.
Well, and that is a lesson for today, too, is because, you know, he was fighting the Pashtuns, much like we are. You know, Pashtuns mm-hmm. occupy the area of what's present-day Afghanistan and Pakistan border. Mm-hmm. That's a British border. That's not their border. And, so he looks, you know, even then he was appalled by the savagery, but I think he realized that you could not win this type of war. Is that a fair assessment?
That is a fair statement. You know, when he goes to the Northwest Frontier in 1897, and like you said, Tim, the Northwest Frontier was part of British colonial India. Today it's, you know, it's the region that, you know, is like the border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and the British had sort of forces in the area to guard against a possible Russian invasion into British India from Afghanistan, but it was kind of expanding its sort of presence in Asia, and the British were kind of worried about that. The Pashtun tribespeople of the region, who are basically their ancestors of the modern day Taliban, you know, they were fiercely independent, did not take kindly to a Western presence there, as is the case today, and they attacked several British forts in the area. And London sent a punitive expeditionary force into the region to sort of, you know, teach the tribesmen a lesson that they would forget, that sort of thing. Churchill is attached, gets a leave from his regiment, joins this expedition in 1897, and he's got a contract to report for the Daily Telegraph. And Cuba was, you know, he saw some fighting in Cuba. He came under fire for the first time in Cuba on his 21st birthday. But what he saw in Cuba were sort of light skirmishes. What he sees in the Northwest Frontier is a lot more barbaric, and the fighting is far more savage. And again, it is fighting of a guerrilla nature. And the force that he's attached to is sent out to sort of burn Pashtun villages. And the villages are surrounded by mountains, and usually what happens is the British troops push the villages, and then the Pashtun tribesmen run out of the hills, you know, firing, you know, swords, rifles. And he sees some very brutal combat. And there's one episode he's involved in where he and some men are sent to destroy a village, and they get separated from the main British Indian column they're attached to, and they're attacked by a large number of Pashtun tribesmen, and they're surrounded. And it really does become a battle to the death. And Churchill isn't sure if he's actually going to survive or not. It becomes a very close-run thing. And he sees fighting on a very barbaric level. But what he realizes is that, you know, these are fierce warriors. They don't back down easily. They're not afraid to die. And they're fighting sort of for their, you know, their home and their property. And after the campaign in the Northwest Frontier, he actually writes a couple of years later, whether or not the whole thing was even worth it. You know, yes, they went and they burned some villages and they killed God knows how many tribesmen. But really, nothing in the region had changed at all. And so he sort of questions sort of the necessity of it. But on the flip side of that coin, though, he still enjoyed the experience. And he writes a letter home to his mother at one point from the frontier when he's in British camp one evening. And the British have dug holes in the ground because the Pashtun tribesmen, they pepper the camp with sniper fire at night. So the British sleep in holes in the ground to shield themselves from the sniper fire. And he writes this letter to his mother, and he says, you know, the fighting here is barbaric. I've seen things that will haunt me forever. But at the same time, it's one of the happiest periods of my life. And Churchill, he did. He thrived on combat. He loved the thrill of combat, although he was appalled by the human cost of it. But there was an aspect to him that really loved the adrenaline. And I think the other thing we need to mention about the Northwest Frontier is his sense of destiny slowly starts to take hold here. He writes to his mother after one particularly grueling battle, paraphrasing here, but he says, I don't believe the gods would create a being as, you know, splendid as I for so crude an ending as death on the battlefield. And he tells her that he believes he's destined to do something great. And in another letter, he tells her that he believes he's going to save the empire someday and preserve the English-speaking people. So even at this age, at 23, he's suddenly getting the sense that maybe he's destined for something great and that destiny will see him through. And that really bolsters his courage even more on the battlefield.
Well, you know, I guess you have something with in common with Winston Churchill, and that probably one of your diary entries talks about you as a splendid individual. You know, so
I don't like to brag, but I'm glad you picked up on it.
Yeah. If you're going to write about yourself, don't mince words. So I'll tell you what, Simon, let's break for the last commercial, and then when we come back, I want to talk briefly about the Sudan. Just briefly on that, briefly about South Africa, and
sure.
then I'm going to ask you what the impact of these correspondent years were, if we could do
sure.
that. Okay, we're talking with author Simon Reed about his new book, Winston Churchill Reporting: Adventures of a Young War Correspondent, and you're listening to him here on the Tim Danny Show. We'll be right back. A good man, real people, clear thinking, enjoyable, quality talk, a new name, EgbertoWillies.com. He talks politics, he talks issues, and you can hear his radio shows and read his blog at EgbertoWillies.com. You can link to him here at Danahy.com. He's also part of CoffeePartyUSA.com's network. Or, if you can spell EgbertoWillies.com, you found a new voice you'll want to hear. EgbertoWillies.com. You hear the music we're playing here on the Tim Danahy Show. We like to feature socially aware music by independent artists across the country. So if you have music or you know a musician who would like us to feature their songs, contact us through Danahy.com. Send us an MP3 version or a link, a little bit about you, and permission to use it on the show. and we'll listen. We'll try to feature it, and we'll post your link for everyone to see. Music is a part of the Tim Danahy Show community. We'd love for you to be that part here at Danahy.com. Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and I'm having a wonderful conversation on air and off air with Simon Reed, who is the author of the new book, Winston Churchill Reporting, The Adventures of a Young War Correspondent. And we've talked about Churchill's youth, unspectacular youth, and we've talked about his experiences and how he developed in the military academy, going to Cuba, fighting in the northwest frontier of India. And you can see what Winston Churchill has experienced. And the book is just, it's alive when you read it. It's just a fun read. It is not a stiff biography, which many people may expect. It's a page turner. And one of the fastest page turners for me was whenever Winston Churchill sailed up the Nile to go be with Kitchener, I guess I need to pronounce it a little bit better, in the Sudan. And, you know, that battle has been glamorized and been made famous by the 1960s movie Khartoum. But there's a chapter in there, Last Charge at Omdurman. And that is just a fabulous chapter of historical war reporting, Simon. Can you talk about Winston Churchill there briefly? Because what I want to do is then go talk about him as a prisoner, and then I want to talk about the influences of these wars on Winston Churchill's later life.
Sure. The chapter, Last Charge at Omdurman, Tim, that is actually my favorite chapter to write, and I think you can probably see why. When you read it, Churchill goes off and joins General Kitchener's reconquest of the Sudan in 1898. Sort of the Islamic tribes in the Sudan had risen up, sort of in rebellion against British sovereignty in the region, and Britain and Egypt sent in a joint army to sort of lay the rebellion to waste, and Churchill wanted to be a part of it, and so he was still a soldier. This time he was attached to the 21st Lancers, the cavalry regiment, and he had a writing contract with the Morning Post, and he goes off with Kitchener into the deserts of Sudan, and this culminates in the battle at Omdurman, and it was really a slaughter. The British Egyptian army numbered about 26,000. The Sudanese army numbered about 60,000. But the British had modern-day weaponry. They had gunboats backing them up on the Nile. They had the Maxim gun. They had artillery. And the Sudanese were armed with swords and sort of ancient rifles. And the battle is a bloodbath. But the most sort of enthralling part of the battle, at least for me, is Churchill's participation in one of the last great cavalry charges in British military history. He and his cavalry regiment, the Lancers, are ordered to charge a line of what they believe are several hundred Sudanese warriors. And so Churchill and his cavalry men, they mount their horses and they take off across the desert. And as they're charging towards this line of enemy combatants, they realize that behind this line of several hundred men, there's a depression in the ground, and in that depression, there's what looks like several thousand men. And so this cavalry regiment of about 350 men charge full throttle into this line of several thousand Sudanese warriors. And Churchill's reporting on it is absolutely, it's mesmerizing. It's fantastic. You really see his command of the language in his reporting. Horses are being speared. Men are being hacked to death. Cavalrymen are they've got their sabers out. They're slashing away. The Sudanese warriors are stabbing with their spears, shooting with rifles. Churchill had a shoulder injury. He fell off a boat in India, dislocated his shoulder, so he couldn't hold a saber. So he charges into it with a pistol in his hand, and by his own account, he kills three men, and he emerges from the cavalry charge without a scratch. But I think if I remember correctly, they lost The regiment lost, I think it was 119 horses and 75 men, if I remember. So, you know, the casualties are quite high. What is telling about the Battle of Omdurman, or what I think is important about it, is we see a real shift in Churchill's attitude towards war. The British and Egyptian army slaughtered the enemy in this battle. The British and Egyptians suffered about 500 casualties. The Sudanese suffered about 30,000. And after the battle, the desert plain is just littered with Sudanese casualties. And Churchill goes off walking among what he believes are the dead, but he realizes that the wounded have also been left to rot with the dead underneath the sort of blazing desert sun. And this is when you see you see a very complex view of war take shape in Churchill. You know, in the Northwest Frontier, you saw savage fighting, but there was still sort of an adventure component to it. In Omdurman, he suddenly realizes that, you know, there is a terrible cost to war, and he comes away not feeling there's no sense of pride in empire, no sense of sort of glory. There's just a sense of disgust, and I think that really shapes his views on war. You know, he was enthralled by combat, but he didn't like the human cost. And so we see him really mature at the Battle of Omdurman. And also the other thing about the Battle of Omdurman is it's a sterling example of sort of like the advent of modern-day weaponry. The British had the Maxim gun, which was one of the first early machine guns, and it was sort of a prologue to sort of the carnage that the machine gun would cause on the Western Front during the First World War.
Well, it is, and I want to bring it forward, and I'm going to ask people to go out and buy the book and then find out for themselves about the what happened in South Africa, because it's fascinating. Winston Churchill was captured and ultimately escaped and coming back. It was really wonderful, and it helped his political ambitions tremendously. But I so I'm sorry to give that short shrift, Simon. We're coming up against a little bit of a time issue here. But I want to project these 5 years of Winston Churchill's life as a war correspondent and a young soldier. And what he saw, was he able to be more clinical about the loss of life? And what I always think about it is a classic moral hazard of Coventry during World War II, in order to protect the fact that the United States had or Britain or Winston Churchill had access to the Germans' secret code, but if they evacuated Coventry, it would have revealed it. So Churchill sacrificed Coventry. That kind of story. Did his experiences there empower him to make the tough decisions in war and make him a more effective leader?
Yeah, it really did. You know, his years as a war correspondent are important for several things. On a superficial level, you know, they introduced him to the pleasures of cigars and whiskey, which became lifelong passions of his. On a you know, more important, deeper level, we see several things, Tim, which sort of impact his leadership during the Second World War. First of all, it helps him hone his incredible command of the English language. He becomes an expert at conveying complex military maneuvers and battles into very simple terms that everyday people can understand. And he puts this to great use in his, you know, stirring speeches of 1940. Secondly, he does see, obviously, firsthand the carnage of war, and he develops a loathing for sort of idiotic leadership. He doesn't like, you know, decisions made that cost, you know, that result in pointless loss of life. And so he is very aware of what soldiers go through on the front line. It gives him a very deep sort of empathy for them. You know, as a war leader in the Second World War, you know, he did cry when he heard of huge loss of life. He wasn't this heartless individual intent on saving empire no matter the cost. He did have a heart. It also shapes his views on diplomacy. This is a very important thing. During his time in South Africa, he realizes that, you know, when you're fighting a war, you have to make it easy for the other side to accept defeat. And if you come out and say, you know, you want unconditional surrender and you're going to put in place punitive measures and ensure a difficult peace, the other side is just going to keep on fighting because they've got nothing to lose by carrying on the struggle. We see this in 1943 at the Battle of conference in Casablanca, where Roosevelt says to the press the Allies are going to accept nothing short of unconditional surrender from Germany. And Churchill, behind the scenes, doesn't like this at all because it doesn't give the Germans any reason to stop fighting. His experience as a war correspondent, it did give him a better understanding of war, probably more so, I think, than any other experience he had. You mentioned the Coventry thing, Tim, and that's interesting because that story's been around for a while, but it's been disputed. So there are people who say that that never happened, and there are people who insist it did. But, you know, as war leader, obviously he had to make tough decisions. He knew the consequences of the decisions he was going to make. But he didn't do it heartlessly. You know, when it came to D-Day, he was not a big fan of D-Day because he feared the loss of life would be horrendous. And he saw firsthand, you know, what poor military decisions and poor strategy could do. So I think that, you know, his years as a war correspondent, more than anything, sort of shaped him into the war leader that he ultimately became.
Well, it is brilliantly written, and I encourage everyone to go out and get this book. It's called Winston Churchill Reporting. The subtitle is Adventures of a Young War Correspondent. For coming on the Tim Danny Show. I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with you.
No, Tim, it was fantastic. I loved it. Thanks.
And hopefully with you.
No, Tim, it was fantastic. I loved it. Thanks.
And hopefully we'll do it again whenever you come out with the next series.
Thank you. I'd love that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Simon.
The Tim Danny Show would like to thank Aaron Taylor of SRC Labs for production management and outreach strategies, and Presonus, a leading designer and manufacturer of audio recording software, hardware, and related accessories available at Guitar Center. For Edward Danahy for post-production assistance, and for all the stations and affiliates who carry the Tim Danny Show. And lastly, to Theodore, the studio bull terrier, for his quiet companionship.